House Committee on Business and Labor. We're going to go a little out of order here today. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2411. Teresa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, House Bill 2411 provides that a person's membership in the public employee retirement system may be terminated by reason of inactivity if the public employee's retirement board gives notice of the impending loss via first class mail to the member's last known address. The bill also requires that the notice must be mailed no less than 3 months or no more than 6 months before the member's five-year anniversary of being inactive. And members, in front of you is a bill analysis and overview from PERS, just for your reference.
And we have Representative Gelser, and I believe a constituent. I'll let you introduce, Representative.
Great. Thank you, Chair Schaffler and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sarah Gelser, and I'm the state representative from Corvallis and Philomath, which is House District 16. I also represent two people who live in Linn County, and they have never, ever voted for me.
I hope so.
Yeah. We'll have to inquire on this one.
It's interesting. It's a fascinating testimony.
Is there more than you wish to tell us?
It's early and it's Wednesday. Thank you very much for hearing this bill. In 2007, I was contacted by my constituent, Susan Aronson, early in the session when it was too late to draft bills. And when she contacted me, she shared with me a very unfortunate experience that she had had with PERS when she went to draw on her retirement account. After PERS reviewed her account status, they discovered that Ms. Aronson had actually gone into loss of membership status many years prior, but she had not been aware of this. And because of that loss of membership status, Ms. Aronson lost years of interest off of her contributions. Ms. Aronson has worked diligently on this issue and came to me with very specific statutory language change requests, which you see in the language in the bill before you. She believes that this will help prevent her situation from happening to other people in the future, even though it's not possible to retroactively go back and fix her particular situation. The hope is this would prevent situations like Ms. Aronson's, where she depended upon income that wasn't ultimately available to her for her retirement. She is here today to share her story, and I actually have to go vote in revenue, but she will be able to answer questions about this bill because she has done an enormous amount of work on it, along with Chris Scaro from my office, who's in the back of the room. So thank you very much for scheduling this hearing, taking the time to hear it, and I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Aronson.
Okay. And I want to thank you, Representative Gelser, for sponsoring this bill on my behalf. I really appreciate that. Chair Mike Schaffler, members of the Committee on Business and Labor, I want to thank you for the opportunity to address you today in support of House Bill 2411. My name is Susan Aronson. I live at 1865 Northwest Lantana Drive in Corvallis, and I'm a retired member under the PERS system. I became a member of PERS in 1975. After a career spanning 31 years and working for several different PERS employers, I retired in May of 2006. I received yearly PERS membership statements, and in 1990, when the form was revised, it clearly stated that I was a vested member. In preparation for retirement, I asked for a pension estimate and chose an option that would have given me $1,200 a month pension. That was in May of 2006. I waited and waited, and eventually, in spite of repeated phone calls, I heard nothing until September of 2006, when I was informed at that point that, in fact, I was not vested because in my early years of employment, and I was placed in loss of membership status 25 years retroactively. At that point, my pension was cut by 45%, and I went from $1,200 a month to $660 a month at that point. All the details of that experience are in my written testimony, which I hope you have available to you. I lost 25 years of earnings without ever having a clue that my membership was in jeopardy. Especially in these difficult economic times, PERS members have a right to know prior to going into retirement a fairly accurate estimate of what their pension will be. Many people base their retirement date on this information. This is only fair, and this is what needs to happen, I believe. House Bill 2411 requires notification of people prior to going into loss of membership status 3 to 6 months before the event happens. And this is only affects inactive people who are inactive at the time that the bill is passed, or up to 4 or fewer years from the date that the bill goes into effect. So this is in no way going to help me in any way. My purpose here today is to prevent other PERS members from facing the same situation that I faced. I know that PERS is concerned about their fiscal impact. I also know that House Bill 2411, that there are right now 23,000 members that are in loss of membership status with PERS who will not be affected by this bill. I personally lost over $14,000 in earnings, and I'm only one person. I wonder how many of those other people that were put in loss of membership status also lost huge sums of earnings. Perhaps these funds could be used to fund this bill. I know when I found out that I was in loss of membership status, or that the PERS thought I should be in loss of membership status, I asked what happened to this money, to my earnings. Where did it go? I spoke to a PERS customer service representative, and they couldn't tell me where this money went. This money, as far as I know, stayed with PERS. I wonder what it's being used for. I believe that House Bill 2411 is an important and necessary revision to ORS 238. It's an equity issue. Right now, PERS says that 86% of people are being identified and notified prior to going into loss of membership status. Those other 14% have as equal right to know prior to that point that they are also going into loss of membership status. All PERS members are entitled to receive information prior to loss of membership status so that they're able to manage their pension funds and prepare properly for their retirement. This is simply the right thing to do. I hope you will support House Bill 2411. There's more detailed information in the testimony that I've written. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, I have some questions. And
yes.
And some of them are just simply for Mr. Cleary and the PERS department.
Okay.
And I imagine your money is in some fund generated interest, so we continue to provide benefits. And I don't know, Representative, if you've spoken to Mr. Cleary or anyone at the PERS board about this, but the 86%, I'd imagine the 14%, some people you probably just can't find. They've moved, they've died, whatever the case may be. And in this computer age, these notifications are just generated, probably, automatically, I'd imagine, somehow, if there's a change in status and set it in some database somewhere. Had you changed addresses or jobs or job location? What do you think brought about this lack of notification in your specific case?
Chairman Schaffler, I'd be glad to answer that question. My case is a bit more complicated. There is some question about whether I worked the required number of hours in my earlier employment. I was operating at that time under ORS 237, which was a different bill. That is my particular issue. I did not move at all. That case is still in litigation, whether PERS was justified in putting me in loss of membership status.
Okay, I don't want to go into your case. I don't know if this is the right venue to, but
probably not.
Have either one of you talked to Paul Cleary about this? You know. Oh, hi. Would some wonderful people from PERS like to come up and just come on up here and give us your side of this? Hate to put you on the spot, but I guess that's what they pay us the big bucks for, right? Since we have Ms. Aronson here, let's air it out. Would you like to come up and just address my question?
Yeah.
And you don't have to speak specifically to this case, but in general, you know, why do we have 14% not being notified? How does a notification process get triggered? In what kind of case would you, why would you notify someone in the first place of them being taken off?
Explain loss of membership.
Yeah, explain loss of membership, exactly. Thank you, Representative.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Susan Riswick with PERS, and I have with me today Yvette Ellich, and she's the administrator for the Customer Service Division, and she'd be happy to address those questions for you.
And I understand, just for the record, if you're in litigation with someone, you can't really talk about a specific case. So.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, normally when we are manually notifying people, it's not automated yet.
Okay.
We are in that process of automating it.
And when will that happen?
In June of this year.
Very good. That'll probably help a lot. Thank you.
We will. So we are notifying about 86% of the people. The other 14% have more complex issues where we have to identify whether they truly are a loss of membership. And loss of membership means that the person has been inactive, either in a non-qualifying position or not working at all for 5 years and they're non-vested.
Okay. All right, that answers. And then how many, what percentage do you, what's your, do you have a goal of what percentage will be notified of losing your membership when you do become automated? Do you have a goal you're going to try and reach?
Well, we are currently in the process of we would like to be in the situation when we are reviewing all of the data before estimates are sent out so that the member is getting the most accurate estimate possible. And we're doing several things to be able to do that. One is letting members know this is the employment history that you have, giving them a lot more information. We're also letting employers know in this June update of our computer system, showing them all the employment we have on the system for them so the employers can also verify that information. The automation that we will be getting would just be on the terminated members, so they actually have to be a dormant member. The fiscal impact is the amount that it is because part of what we would like to do is also identify those folks in a non-qualifying position where they might have been qualifying for a couple years and then they've not working as many hours as they should, but the employer has never terminated them. Mm-hmm. Our system is looking for that termination, and we would like it to be looking at qualifying and non-qualifying so we can identify them and notify them at the same time.
And you know, I'll open it up to questions here in a minute, as soon as I'm done with this one. You know, so many times in government, the problems we run up against is simply a lack of information and knowledge and a lack of communication by one or both parties. And here I think we can avoid this. And I have no idea how many cases like this are out there, how many appeal, how many court cases, how many are resolved. And if you want to share that with us later, you can. But I really am glad you're doing that automation and reaching out, and even those that, you know, have been not just those that have been terminated, but those that may be in the middle of or coming up. Any questions of these good people? All righty then.
Mr. Chair, please.
Thank you.
I just would like to kind of make it clear, I guess, for my own, Ms. Aronson, is that pronounced correctly?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So what you were vested in PERS for a period of time, your hours adjusted. And then you became all of a sudden inactive by PERS status, but didn't know that. Is that what occurred?
Yes, sir. Chair Schaffler and Representative Matthews, let me answer that question. Yes, I had no knowledge that I was in anything but a full member of PERS until several months after I had retired and after receiving an estimate from PERS. Yes.
Okay, and follow, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious because I deal with the PERS system with a lot of other folks, and it seems like when they're about 3 months out, they set up appointments with PERS, they sit down with their counselors, and they work out their arrangement. They know exactly what they're going to get when they leave. Did you have an opportunity for that, or did you not do that, or where did the system break down for you here?
I asked for an estimate of my pension, and I received that over email. I filled out all the forms, dotted every T, dotted every I, crossed every T, got everything notarized, sent everything in, and that was in, I was retiring in May, so that went in. I got the estimate in February, I sent all the forms in March. And then May came, and I waited, and then I started calling when my retirement date had long since passed, and was never given any information. They just said everything that we're investigating. We can't tell you how long it's going to take. And then it wasn't until September that I received a letter from PERS. At that point, telling me what their decision was, and that I was put in Rawson membership status 25 years retroactively.
I see. Thank you.
So I would hope that every public employee knows their status when they're going in. We have to sign a thing, and I've signed on to it. Some legislators choose not to, and God bless them. And then along that process, if someone changes occupation, it's non-qualifying, even if they're in the public system, that then they get notified, and I would like them to verify that they've been notified, and maybe that caused something too, but that way I can imagine someone, okay, they're notified, they don't get it, they don't read it, they ignore it, they throw it away, whatever, and then they work 10 more years thinking, without checking their status. Annually, aren't we notified of our status somehow? Isn't that going on now? How do we do this?
Chair Schaffler, I can answer a couple of those questions. We do send out annual statements, and as Ms. Aronson pointed out, she did receive annual statements. Mm-hmm. One of the challenges that we have right now is verifying data early enough so that members do know their status. And for most of the career employees, that's not an issue. They work in a qualifying position their whole mm-hmm. career. But we now track substitute teachers and a lot of part-time and seasonal employees. And it has been a real challenge to make sure that they have the correct notification and correct verified data in their account balance. So currently we're in a mode of verifying that data prior to retirement or prior to a withdrawal. What we would like to do is move that process prior to an estimate, early on in their career so yeah. that they're not in this situation. So we hear you. We know that that is an issue, and we are working towards that. We are trying to pay retirement benefits within 45 days, so we're in the process of verifying all that data as quickly as possible. Unfortunately, it does often happen at the time of right prior to a benefit being paid. And that is our business plan to move it forward in a member's career so they're not in the situation.
And we definitely can't wait till we're Correct. Retiring. That it has to be an ongoing. And how we do that, how you do, and I'm sure no one intends to do this. It's a system. And Ms. Anderson, did you want to respond to anything that was just... I saw your hand up.
Oh, yeah, Chair Schaffler, I just wanted to verify what actually you said, that I did receive yearly membership statements, and including the fact that I was vested in those statements. Yes.
Representative Shannon.
I guess I'm still lost on a couple of details. You were employed, I guess, full-time for less than 5 years. Is that how that worked? And then you went to... I'm not quite sure what happened 25 years before you retired.
Right.
So what was the incident that created this status?
Okay. Chair Schaffler and Representative Kennemer, I can answer that question. I worked part-time throughout my career, and during the time when I was raising my young children, I was very part-time. I was always working for a PERS employer, and that never lapsed for more than 4 years. The rules under ORS
237 were much less specific than they are at the present time under ORS 238. And so that is in litigation of whether my time actually qualified during those early years.
Okay. Please, I have a question for the PERS people. I understand that your policy has changed, and how would this bill affect your operation at this point if we were to move forward with it?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Kennemer. This bill would make it mandatory that we notify 100% of those people that fall into the loss of membership status. Our challenge is we can identify those members that have terminated and then not worked for the 5 years. And the fiscal impact shows that in order to catch the non-qualifying members, that we would have to need to enhance our computer system to do that. We, employers, because we're tracking substitute teachers, part-time seasonal folks now, employers will just leave them on the system and not terminate them. And one of the computer triggers is to look for that termination. So that it's not so much as a policy change, because we would like to notify those people. It's just making it mandatory would give them the membership if we can't find them or don't notify them. And then they would get the earnings and possibly the service credit on their account.
And you're dependent on the employer's diligence.
Yes.
So you could technically, if you had the scenario you dispelled out, you could have someone, if the employer, for whatever reason, doesn't terminate that person, they could be on there for 30 years.
Yes.
Get a benefit that they did not accrue.
Yes.
So that, and I don't know how we solve that one, although they should be diligent. We all need to be diligent. So, on the other hand, here we have this case, too. So, Representative, did you need...
Okay, I think we're set.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, I'm clearing my thoughts here. Employers don't provide notice of termination. How does the money get from the employer to the PERS accounts?
Vice Chair Cameron, Chair Schaffler. Employers submit data to us once a month. We send them statements, and they submit contributions twice a month. Some employers do it by payroll, so it could be every 2 weeks, once a month. But we used to get the data from them once a year, and now we have an electronic reporting system that they do online. So we get the data real time, monthly or weekly, and they're able to keep up on the member data. So we're getting a lot more data than we used to get on members that may not be qualifying. We used to only track qualifying members. So we actually can see a better picture of the member to see whether they're qualifying or not. And the employers submit that the money when they submit their payroll records.
So you are getting information if a person all of a sudden drops off the radar screen that the employer's not paying in.
Yes.
There should be some trigger here that says this person's gone dormant or whatever, that they could fall into a non-qualifying status. The information's coming today that we would need on 100% of the employees that are in the program. Is that not true?
Chair Schaffler, Vice Chair Cameron, we do get that data. However, our current computer system is not to trigger the loss of membership notification or the status. It doesn't look at the qualifying, non-qualifying. That would be the enhancement that we would need.
Okay, that's really where I want to get to, because Mike Schaffler, the legislative admin here, sends in a contribution for me, mm-hmm. either every 2 weeks or every month. In my case, I think it's every month, but I don't care. So I, for whatever reason, am no longer working here. Now that money shuts off, because they're not going to, unless they're really screwed up, and God knows, that money is going to shut off when my employment is terminated.
Mm-hmm.
And what we need here, what you're telling me, is you need some system, software, whatever, that not only does it show that that money shut off, but then also trigger a notification. I don't know how much that costs, but I tell you what, I think it would be worth it to avoid pain and suffering of someone who's about to retire. And I think all of us human beings think this, to avoid this. And I don't know how it takes or how much it costs, but I'm very interested in pursuing that because I don't want a bunch of Ms. Harrisons before this committee, and I know you don't either. So however you want to do that, I'd like to figure that out, and I'd like to do that. So I think we could get a lot of support for putting that system in place.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I got Representative Barton. Did you want to follow up?
I would like to.
I'm not in the queue, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I'm just sitting there thinking, if this was a private employer,
my homeboy,
if this was a private employer and I told my employees this is how much money you're going to qualify for upon retirement, I'm telling you, this group right here would be all over some bill if one of my employees was sitting here and said, by the way, I was told I was going to have this much money upon retirement, and 6 months later somebody cut it by 40%. This to me is an issue that this state needs to deal with, and I don't care how much money it costs, because it would not be a fiscal on a private employer to tell the employees of this state that this is what they qualify for. And when we're talking about money that costs our states, we're looking at people here who are being misled in a retirement program that needs to get its act together. That's all I'll say.
And I know exactly how much I'm getting from the Labor's Union when I retire. And, anyway, I'm not going to talk about what would happen if that didn't happen. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Representative Cameron, and I'm not sure, but I would hope that we have a system today in place in this state where we would be able to trigger COBRA notification letters on the health insurance side of the equation, and I would have to presume that it's not that much of a reach to be able to do the same thing for a pension. And I realize that these good folks here today in front of us are not responsible for our lack of capacity to do this, but
you're right.
I would just ask them to carry back to the administration at PERS that, I mean, we have a person in front of us here today who planned her retirement, and I don't think there's a person here on the dais or in the audience or listening in today that can't sympathize with someone who has had her retirement destroyed because of this. And this pains me greatly. I know it pains the rest of this committee greatly, and this is totally inappropriate. And again, I don't want to launch on anyone here. I truly do not want to do this, but we have someone sitting before us who has come here, has worked for the state in good faith, and now finds herself in a position where her retirement dreams, and I think all of us do, we plan on our retirement. And I have a feeling that this woman's, Ms. Aronson's retirement is destroyed. This is something that we need to take responsibility for as a state. We can't do this. We need, as Representative Cameron said, if this were a private employer, we'd be all over that employer. And I would very easily get all over PERS on this. I'm not going to allow myself to do that today. But we need to get this corrected, and we need to have that capacity as soon as possible.
And we haven't established whether or not Ms. Aronson truly was qualified or not. We don't have the facts. We don't know. We have her testimony, and I know you're not discussing that. Whatever the worker is, if they have qualified and have established a work background and have been contributing, we want to make darn sure, and I know you do too, that they get what they got coming. And if they aren't contributing, and if they have lost membership, they need to know. They can't work for 10 years and then find out, oh, wait a minute, I'm here all along. That's the problem here. We have someone who thought, or at least believed, and may well have been a member, but clearly maybe didn't and didn't know. Somehow we have to make sure every worker knows whether they're in or they're out, and not wait until they're... And what I want to do is I want to help you good people do that. So, and you know what? I don't know if we can get that done this session, what needs to be done this session, but I think this is definitely something we need to address soon, if not this session, over the interim, discuss it, and maybe even in January, February when we come back. And you, I want you to come and tell me and us what you need to avoid this, and then we just need to do it, because we can't have people's dreams crushed. So with that, Representative Kennemer, and then we're going to move on, folks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess so a couple of things that I want to say. First of all, it's probably the only PERS retiree on the dais. I've been through this system a little bit. A couple of things, I guess, in fairness, is PERS in the legislature had some issues about funding and provision of staff over the years, and greatly underfunded that program. And there used to be extraordinary service, and then there was a period where it was hard to access service other than through the Internet. And in fairness, everything I always received very clearly explained an estimate, which was very hard to accept, too, because an estimate is not real helpful when you're trying to do planning. But I think there's a lot of blame to go around about why things aren't in a little bit better shape. And frankly, PERS has dramatically improved their customer service lately. And I, as the recipient, appreciate that. But I think, and I appreciated Representative Witt's restraint, I think we need to understand this is a complicated mess and we're all participants in it. And the legislature gets a great deal of blame, and there's been a lot of effort to shape it up. And then this is complicated when people move, or when the employers don't properly notify. There's a lot of slippage here. Very important matter. I don't mean to hate to think what my Irish temper would do if I were in your circumstance. But I think. You know, we need to realize, and I have one little concern about this, too, is you know, 100% is sort of what the bill is asking for. That's a bit much. I don't know any of us that achieve perfection. That ought to be our goal, by gum. And there ought to be ways, you know, maybe a better solution is to look at ways to rectify things that are clearly wrong. And I think most panels would say what happened here was clearly wrong.
Well, I don't know if it's clearly wrong. Once again, I don't
have... Well, assuming the details are...
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you, that's right.
That's not what we're going to establish here today, and that's not the purpose of this hearing, and I know Ms. Aronson knows that. I think it was pretty clear where this chair wants to go, and I'm confident, and I know you want to go there, and I want you to come and tell us what you need to get there. So I really do appreciate you bringing this to us, Ms. Aronson. I wish you luck. But we're going to follow up on this. At the least, so I look for Mr. Cleary's doing a great job, and good luck to you. You want any parting comments that may generate more questions? All right.
I just wanted thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I really appreciate it.
You're more than welcome. Thank you for bringing it to our attention. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close public hearing, House Bill 2411. Members, I will ask Teresa to write Mr. Cleary a nice little note that we are interested in this issue and we want to follow up on it and make sure we're giving them everything they need to do their best to avoid this from happening. And you're right, Representative, no one's perfect. I gave up on that quest a long time ago myself, obviously. With that...
Can we comment on that?
No, there's no comment on that issue.
I think you should open a work session on that one.
That would be a long work session, Representative. Alrighty then. Are we ready to just go right down the line? Speaking of work sessions, I'm going to open one on House Bill. Okay, you know what? I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2660. And then Do you want to just explain what we're doing here? And it has an amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We first heard House Bill 2660 on March 2nd. It increases the maximum amount of revenues from civil penalties assessed for violations of occupational safety or health statutes that can be credited to the Workers' Memorial Scholarship account from $250,000 to $1 million. During a testimony, Michael Wood from Oregon OSHA had a suggestion of making the bill, instead of mandatory, permissive, in which you have in front of you a dash one amendment that changes the proverbial word shall to may, and that accomplishes that. We have the paperwork in front of us to move the bill to that.
Okay. We have the department in the room. Does anybody have any questions about this? I think the sponsor just had to go and take care of some business. We're just going to take a moment here, folks, and wait for Representative Holvey and to come down and vote. Are there any questions of the department? It's pretty fairly simple, straightforward. Changing shall to may when they have the money to do it.
Thank you.
Which is a meritorious thing to do. All right, we're just going to wait patiently here. Everyone will just relax for a moment.
Do we have to wait patiently?
No, you do not.
Thank you.
We'll recess for 3 minutes. We want to open it back up. I would appreciate a motion to adopt the dash one amendments into House Bill 2660.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I move that the committee accept or adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2660.
Representative Barton move dash one amendments into House Bill 2660. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, shall to may is fine at this time, but obviously we want to make sure that in the future we are filling this, and we'll need to make sure we continue to watch this particular fund. As today, I read in the paper, I believe it was, we had about 40 people die in Oregon last year on the job. And those people potentially have young children who are going to go to college someday, and this scholarship money will really make a difference in their lives.
Representative, I couldn't agree more, and I just want to thank you for bringing this forward and bringing it to our attention. And it has tremendous merit, and I definitely personally will follow up on this, and I believe everyone here in the dais will follow up on it. And when times are better, I'm confident that, I think through the interim that we could keep in touch with the department and find out where we're at on this and see, how we're doing. And maybe they will move in this direction underneath this legislation, and then maybe someday make it shall. So thank you. And you're exactly right. I'm confident those workers have family members that can and will benefit from this. Any further discussion or questions? Any opposition to the motion? All right, then, so I'll move. I would appreciate a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2660 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2660 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition to the bill? All right, then, so move. Representative Cameron, would you like to carry this?
Be happy to.
All right, very good. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2660. I'm going to open public hearing on House Bill 2745.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2745 allows Jackson County to charge an additional fee for premium services in excess of the actual cost of processing a development review permit. The measure also requires the county, prior to charging the additional fee, to adopt a fee schedule and the standards for justifying the fee. There is a sunset clause in the measure for January 1st, 2014. There is a minimal fiscal impact on the bill, and we are waiting for the revenue analysis.
Very good. Representative Escobar, would you like to go first, or would your witness like to go first?
Good morning, Representative Schaffler and members of the Business and Labor Committee. My name is Kelly Matting. I'm the Development Services Director with Jackson County. Before you is House Bill 2745, which would allow Jackson County to charge a premium rate for premium service. This would be for land use applications that would range from commercial site plan reviews to major partitions to conditional use permits. The program will be voluntary. Our timelines for our what we would call our regular customers, the customers that we have now, would not be compromised. Right now, the county is under state statute to provide a decision on land use applications inside an urban growth boundary in 120 days and outside an urban growth boundary in 150 days. Those timelines would not be compromised by the advent of this program. I think that we've talked to some representatives. For example, we talked to a realtor group about this concept. It was a familiar concept to them. The private sector does this in regulatory environments such as the Postal Service. People are used to paying a little bit more if they want their letter delivered in 2 days as opposed to six or four. In terms of who benefits, I think all of our customers at the county would benefit. I think primarily the users of this program would be commercial and industrial customers. As we are often asked, could we be moved up in your queue if we were to pay more, or could we be moved up in your queue? We have, we're going to be providing jobs for county residents. And right now, we don't have that ability. Under state law, we're required to charge average or actual cost. At Jackson County, we charge average cost for land use applications. And as any of you who've been through a land use process, you get in a queue, and you're in a queue regardless of what kind of benefit you may bring to the county, i.e., in this case, jobs or urban or industrial or commercial development. I think for the region, for our region, this the availability of this program would help us recruit and retain job-creating enterprise. Like all other places in Oregon, we're competing for businesses who are looking at a variety of other areas, including other states, that have different land use laws. And this program wouldn't subvert any land use laws. Everyone would be required through this program to go through the normal land use procedures. And then in terms of the benefit to Jackson County, it would help us better cover the true cost of land use actions that we experience. It's estimated when we went through and looked at this program or looked at kind of creating a program like this, we anticipated that about 16% of applicants or applications may avail themselves of a program like this, which would yield about $77,000 under the current economy. Last year we had about 318 land use applications that may qualify for a program like this, and we anticipated about 16% would probably avail themselves. We would use that money to, and given the current economy and the current level of land use applications that we have, to either contract out for services, these expedited services, be able to pay people overtime. If the program took off, I think I would anticipate that we may be able to hire an additional staff person who would be dedicated to a program like this. I think this is a good, given the economy today, and frankly, regardless of it, in some sense, I think a program like this is timely, and I ask for your support.
We before we go to a good representative, we have done things like this before, established a premium queue to move things along faster. Why just Clackamas County? Why just Jackson County? Why not Clackamas County, Union County, all 36 counties? That's my question.
Representative Schaffler, I think that when we looked at this, we didn't know how palatable it may be to the legislature, and we thought, well, you know, let's try a pilot program with Jackson County. But I don't see a reason why this couldn't be broadened to the entire state.
Right. I'm more comfortable with that idea, Representative. I share that with you. Go ahead, Representative. We'd like to hear your insight.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, Chair,
if I could interrupt the
Representative. I have somebody in the queue already, Representative.
Well, it was germane to your comment.
Well, Representative Edwards, was your question germane to my comment?
No.
All right, then go ahead, Representative.
I guess part of the question, and I hope the good representative will also answer this, is in Clackamas, this is Jackson is not a home rule charter county, is it? Is it home rule?
Yes.
So is that the reason you need the statutory authority? Because in Clackamas County, we already do that. And we have an expedited program.
Right.
We pay a premium for it. It's a very simple process. And so I'm a little confused about why there's the need for a legislative authorization to do this.
Huh?
We researched that pretty darn carefully and implemented it about 2 or 3 years ago, if my memory serves me correctly.
And that's what I was searching for.
And yeah, and that's why I wanted to get it out, and I just wanted to understand what was...
Okay.
You have three commissioners in Jackson County, don't you?
That is correct.
So it's not a home rule charter.
Well, we round up all the counties that fall under this and apply it to them.
Well, I don't think they need this authority, is my point. I don't know. I think we need to do some research.
Yeah,
and maybe
okay.
The representative can shed some light on this.
Very good.
Because we do it already in Clackamas County.
And I want to help them do it. Representative, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sal Esquil, Representative District 6, Medford. Jackson County is a home rule charter. Our attorneys in Jackson County researched this out and understood that they do need to have permission from the state in order to achieve this. As for blanketing all home rule charters and anyone in the state, I don't have a problem with that at all.
Either.
I think that's a good process. And the reason I think that is good, because we know, and you know, Representative Kinnerman, from being a commissioner, that you have certain time frames in order to do land use in the first place. So you have one set of tracking right there on land use itself, and that's a time clock no matter who turns in an application. But this will allow people that want to pay the premium to get something through the planning process quicker, the ability to pay that. In fact, the developmental community was the one that brought this forward to Jackson County. They requested this, which I think this is a good partnership in order to achieve and expedite projects within our county or the state of Oregon. I think it's a good economic development tool. I think it allows people to fast track into something. And most of the people that will do this will be, of course, commercial. It won't necessarily be residential, but it'll be mostly your commercial ventures. So I think it's a very good approach to this. But more importantly, it comes back to you get for what you pay for. If you want to do a fast track, you can pay more. But if not, you can go through the regular system, and you will not be deterred in the regular system time-wise. It will be the same time frame no matter what.
And Representative, I remember we had the same concept before Representative Brown's Business Labor Consumer.
2005.
And what came up was, for those who want to get out and have money, they actually loosen up the queues, that those that aren't really in a big hurry, it moves them along faster too. So everybody actually moves faster. And I can't remember specifics of why we were talking about
Mr.
that.
Mr. Chair, and you're and getting some memories back there, and I think it was in the 2005 session that we went through this.
Yes.
But I can't remember exactly what it was for.
I do remember having that same conversation.
Yeah, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and Lord knows we need to loosen up the permitting process, especially for folks that are going to be creating jobs. You spoke of benefit that somebody might bring to the county with their project. My concern is, just my gut reaction, is that it doesn't slow folks that aren't willing to pay the premium down. And so I'm interested in some comment on how close to capacity is the permitting staff and the folks that work on these things operating right now. I mean, if you were just at capacity and somebody's paying a premium to go to the front of the line, it seems to me, and with that premium it's not funding more staff time, it seems to me that it has to bump people back in line.
Well,
that aren't paying the premium. So I'm just interested in some comment, because I do want to make it easier for folks. I just don't want it to be at the expense of everybody that can't afford that.
And on that right there, I have to go back and find out now. You've really picked my interest, because we established what you just said would not be the case, that there would be two queues that would be staffed, that would be moving along in parallel to one another, not saying, I'm a rich guy, I got all this cash, I want to be at the head of the line. That's definitely not what we did. And you want to respond to that, and then I'm going to Representative Thatcher.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually what you have now is you have a big group here that these time frames are out. Okay? What we're doing is we're segregating out people that want to fast track, which in turn relieves the pressure in this group here. Because they, with additional staff and additional monies, can source this out into the private sector on the engineering and the planning part, which in turn fast tracks, but it loosens up the staff here to do a better job for anyone that comes in with a residential or whatever. But it does help both tracks, actually.
Right. That makes sense.
And we need to put that in the bill that that's required. Oh, it is required.
I believe it is.
Mr. Chair, yes, it is in there. Yes.
Okay, very good.
Good, line 10 of the bill, yes.
That's what I need. Well, Representative Thatcher passed. I think you're onto something here. I want to follow up and pursue it and help you out, because we need to start rebuilding and building America, improving America, and developing America. Progress. I call that progress. Some people don't think it's progress, but I do think it's progress, because we need Americans working in the state. Representative Esco, you have some final words.
Yes, actually, thank you, Mr. Chair. You and I have quite a similar outlook on jobs. You know, there's no doubt about that.
That would be the right one, Representative.
And I think this is part of our economic toolbox in your particular region. But if the chair and this committee feels that we should, in fact, blanket the state with this for anyone that is in need of it. I think it's a great tool, but we didn't want to come up and say, okay, we want to do this for the whole state. We thought, well, we'll just do a pilot program in our particular county because we know the needs of our county. We do not know the needs of, example, Clackamas, but obviously they're already there.
Well, we're going to do an amendment to do the whole state, and we'll run it up the flagpole and see what happens. Did you have something, Representative?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anyone from the Counties Association to address this?
There will be when we have the amendment, probably. Are you from the counties?
Yeah. I don't see them. I'm surprised, and I think we need to hear from them about this.
We'll just put some of my labor stuff in there, and they'll be here the next time. All right. Representative Barton.
Mr.
And
Chair.
By the way, it's Representative Barton's birthday today. I forgot to know.
Thank you.
Are
thank
we singing?
Chair.
No, yeah, I'm going to buy him his first drink today downstairs.
I know. I'm legal to drink
really.
Now.
It'll be his first drink, yes,
Mr. Chair, I just want to be clear. First of all, I think I'm all for expediting and facilitating commercial permitting, and particularly if people are willing to pay for the increased services. That sounds great. But before we amend this bill and run it up the flagpole, I think actually Representative Kenemer's question about the threshold, is this legislation necessary, is absolutely critical to me. I think he has a very good point, and I'm sure you have excellent counsel, and perhaps we could chat with them, or I could chat with them offline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, I would think that it would be, and the reason I think it would be is, one is that the attorneys in Jackson County wanted it, and LC did not come out and say, you know, you can do this anyway.
Well, they can if they change their charter, but that's a far more painful process to go down.
And Mr. Chair, that goes right out to the voters themselves, and sometimes, you know, it's a pretty expensive process.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Expensive and painful. And all kinds of things. Yes, Representative.
No, I'm sure that the attorneys in Jackson County are better than the attorneys in Clackamas County. Present company excluded, of course. But
there's a constituency.
But I would like to follow up on this because it's an assumption that might be questioned.
All righty then. Any further questions or comments on this bill? And we will follow up on it. Yes, Representative.
I think
please.
You would like to answer.
Chair and Representative Kenemer, I think there are two things. One is that ORS 215-416 speaks to land use permitting and how one would charge for that. And it specifically says that you can charge actual or average cost. The other piece is, and I think maybe Clackamas County avails themselves of this like Jackson County does, is you can charge for expedited review. Expedited review is very narrow in terms of its scope. It doesn't cover every land use activity or permit. And I'm assuming that, well, maybe Clackamas County does something like that like we do. This legislation would be broader than that.
I think you're probably correct, and I appreciate that. I'm not sure of the details.
Okay.
Well, we're going to find out.
We'll find out.
Because I want to help you. I agree with you. And I think most of us, if not all of us, do agree with you, too. So with that, unless you don't have anything more to say, does anyone else want to testify on this bill? All right. Well, we will follow up with you and through your good representative, and I appreciate you bringing this to attention. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2475. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2747.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2747 limits the fees that governing bodies may charge for conducting reviews of proposed changes to property in historic districts to no more than $100.
I got this one confused with that one, to be quite frank with you.
Same sponsor, so it's easy to...
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Been a while since I've been here. I'm glad to be in front of you. Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. Let me explain to you how we got to this place. I own a 1906 home. This home is in a historic district, which is fine, although I have no tax abatement from that. None at all. So I'm under the jurisdiction of a historic district, which is fine. I went to build a garden shed. Now, I had two options. I could have, well, actually, I had three, because I could have went to Home Depot, or I could have went to Lowe's and bought a tin shed and threw it in the backyard, and no one could have said anything about that. But I elected to build this shed, this garden shed, mind you, and to do it exactly like the architectural design of the house itself. So I sought out and found, example, the siding itself is $1 a running foot. It's a 10 by 12 shed, and there's $875 just in siding in that particular building, just for the siding. I also sought out and found 6-over-1 windows for the to match what I have in the house. I also sought out and found shingles that were similar to what we had in 1906. So I wanted this to look like the house itself. Well, I'm plugging away out there, and I did call the building department in the city of Medford and said, do I need a permit? And the answer was no, because it's not over 200 square feet. So I'm plugging away out there and building like crazy. And the neighbor comes up and said, you know, you need a permit for that. And I said, well, no, I've called the building department, and no, I don't. No, you need one through the planning department. Okay, so I stop, go down, talk to the planning department. Yeah, you do. You need one. Okay, how much is it? $25. Okay. So, and I said, I'm also replacing my existing fence. Okay, that's another $25. Mind you, an existing fence, 32 feet of it. I had to pay $25 for a permit. Okay, fine. Well, I paid the $50 to get the permit, and then three planners come out and said, you know, we can't give you a permit for the garden shed. Why not? Well, you have to go through historical review. Okay, that's fine if that's what you want. I don't have a problem with that. You know, that's $430. So my little garden shed...
That's because they sent three of them out there to take care of it.
It's getting very expensive. So I said, well... First of all, my wife was screaming like a mashed cat there because all of a sudden we have a $500 bill involved in a garden shed that we could have bought a tin shed over at Lowe's or Home Depot, threw it in the backyard, and we'd have been fine. But anyway, so we talked about it, and they said, well, I'll tell you what, we'll just drop it down to $230 because you don't have any structural permits. Well... That, you know, coming from a city background, which some of us have, we know that if you go into a structural permit, you have to go to the building department, you have to get a permit anyway, so that would more than make up for the difference between the $200 they dropped. So we wanted justification of what this money was for. And they said, well, it's for staff time. Okay, so we paid the $230. We go to the meeting. And by the way, the meeting was a month away. So I had to cease and desist until a month later. This was in October and it's starting to rain in November. So anyway, we go to the meeting. We have a group of five or seven people, whatever it is, on the commission, and present. And the staff time consisted of the staff report, is what I was told. But unfortunately, what it amounted to was what we turned in with the design, with the dissertation of what we were trying to achieve. It was a matter of making seven copies of that and giving it to the commissioners. That's what staff time was about. So I guess what I'm coming from is, why on earth would we, as a municipality, a county, or a state, penalize someone for trying to do what's right? Because that's exactly what we're doing. I had the, my wife and I had the caringness to make sure that this was done properly, so we were penalized. Now, having done some further research on this, I found out that this not only happened to me, but many other people in the district itself. In fact, most of the neighbors will not go to the city now. So we've created a problem. Did you know in Medford that if you want to paint your house the same color it is in a historic district, it costs you $430 to ask for permission? I had someone in the back of my home in the 1970s put in T111. Do you know how good that looks with all the vertical siding you have from 1906 and then to have T111 on the back side? Not very shiny. But if I would have left that separate in order to ask permission to pull the siding down and put up siding like I have, it's $430. This is nothing to do with your historic homes. This has to do with raising money. And let's call a spade a spade. They are making money on us. So I have worked out this bill that would limit the amount to $100. And by the way, I was on the council when we first started this process, and it started at $50. Now, we ran amok there some way to $430 on raising fees. But upon talking to different entities, and I'm sure the League of Oregon Cities will probably be against this, because what we're doing here, which is very unfortunate, is you have one bad child, so you end up disciplining 240 other children. So I've worked with the City of Portland. By the way, the City of Portland has quite a unique way of where they help people. And that's what we should be doing with historic homes. You want to preserve historic homes, so you want to reward or help people in order to maintain that, not make it a detriment like the City of Medford is doing. So what we have done is two things. One is I have an amendment which I have not submitted to you because I have a couple of amendments to amend this bill to make it to where it's very distinct on how this process works throughout the state. One is we want to make sure that it's just for residential. Two, with the help of the City of Portland, we have written, and I have not received this from LC yet, this amendment, and the exception of fees that this amendment will read, the exception of fees that do not require a building permit, in other words, there is no fees unless there's a building permit, unless it changes the element that is part of the historic listing. So in other words, unless you're changing the element of the historic significance of that home or the architectural design and you need a permit, it shouldn't cost you anything. It shouldn't cost you $430 to go ask if, can I paint my house the same color it originally was. So that's the intent of this bill. It's unfortunate that I am here with a bill against my own city that I represent. But I did talk to four council members, and they elected not to do anything about it. They still want to charge you $430 to ask permission to paint your house. Any questions?
Only to say that that's pretty absurd. And you know what we do? What we do in this, in cases like this, when you clearly, Representative, went to great lengths to match the historical architecture of your neighborhood, in what you could, you just could have put up a tin shed, which probably would have been in violation, I'd imagine. But to go to great lengths and great spend that amount of money, and then to have this happen. Then what happens? Your neighbors hear about it, and you know what now? Now we've created a society of scofflaws because of the system dumping all over people and charging exorbitant rates for nothing. The $435 to paint your house, the same color. It's absurd. So anyway, and I got my stories about permitting and all that too. Just so I have this straight though, if there's what you want to do is it would limit the fee to $100. If there's no architectural change and there's no design or plan examination due to any structural change, because then you would need a permit. Am I getting all this correct?
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair, for the question. Actually, what I will do is I will take the $100 limit cap off of it and insert the wording that I had described, that if there is no permit involved, you shouldn't be charged anything. I mean, I it just astounds me that you would be charged to paint your own house.
You should just submit.
And I understand this, the reasoning for a historic commission. But what is interesting is that in Portland, it's all done administratively until such time that someone appeals it. Then it goes to a commission. And I think that's really a very good way to do this, because the staff knows the rules, they understand what we're trying to achieve, and if it's an appeal process, then it should go to the historic commission, and then they should determine what is what with it. But you can go to the but Medford, it immediately goes to the historic commission, period, and staff doesn't have much input on it until such time it does go to that
commission. And then some more technical questions just for me, and then I'll open it up. If you own a home inside of a historical district, you're required to follow certain rules and whatever it is. Is your home a national historic site, or you just live inside an historic district?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, my home was on the historical registrar.
Register, that's what I said.
But it came off, so I have no tax advantage whatsoever.
But you're still in.
But I'm still in a district. Now, even if my house had not been on the historical registrar, I would still have to comply with the historic district rules.
Right.
Even though maybe I didn't want to be in the historic district, and the city itself overlays the historic district. So they not only overlay your district, but then they also charge you for permission to do anything to that home.
To paint your house the same color. Any questions, Representative Edwards?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't know that much about historic districts, but I'm learning here from this exchange.
They're really fun, actually.
So,
and Representative, I'm not against historical districts, and I'm not against a historical registrar or any of that stuff, but we need to have some common sense instilled into the system we're doing here in Oregon. Representative.
Well, obviously it doesn't cost $430 to make 7 copies or however many copies had to be made of the stuff that you prepared to turn in. I presume that when they say staff time, that is they have staff that they presume that they have to have. And so what I'm want, and that's, you know, the permits are, you know, however much work they review in a year's time or a month's time, and they divide it out and they come up with this number, $430 is what it costs to maintain that staff. Do they, and these are just presumptions on my part, does this staff do other things, or do they have staff that's just dedicated to the historic district, or what? Fill me in on all that, how the
Edwards, and I'm looking at Representative Witt, because I kind of threw this out through our subcommittee. The question is, which my wife here is, she's really the boss here on this situation. The question was, do you have someone...
This situation?
Well, we know that, right?
Sorry, just too good.
Representative Chopper, he knows exactly
I'm in the
I'm
same situation.
About.
I'm eternally grateful.
The question... My wife asked, "Was what do you have? Someone back in a closet here that when I write the checkout, then they go to work?" Well, no, they're on staff all the time. Well, then why don't you explain to me why we're paying for staff time if they're here in the first place? That's the big question. And let's be factual here. This amounts to raising money. That's all it amounts to. And they can take a good shot at you, and why they justify $430, I don't know where they dug that one up.
And we're going to get them up here to follow up here in just a moment to justify what they do with all that money. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and my follow-up is, does that, in this case in particular, I know it might be different in every city and every historic district, but in this case in particular, does the staff do other functions for other departments, and so they just have a little bit of time that they work on the historic district stuff, or does the historic district have a full-time staff person that that's all they do, whether they have anything to do or not, and your fees are paying for them to...
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, they work on staff in the city of Medford as a planner.
Okay. That's really helpful to me. Thank you.
Mrs. Esquivel, how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. Jan Esquivel from District 6 and Chief of Staff for Representative Esquivel. Representative Schaffler, Chair Schaffler, I'd like to clarify something, and the only reason I came down other than probably to defend myself on the mashed cat statement.
Oh, you're watching.
is that our house is on the National Historic Register.
Oh, okay.
It is a National Historic on that registry.
Okay.
We have removed it from the State Historic Registry for tax purposes.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, when I believe last session or perhaps in 2005, we had a bill that kind of recycled our state historic properties, and that if you'd been on, you came off after 15 years and then you could register to go back on. We have not registered to go back on the State Historic Registry.
Okay. Okay.
And I will be honest with you, the purpose for doing that is that we had some improvements, such as replacing the siding, that we wanted to do on the house, and if we're under the state rules and regulations, it's more difficult to do that. So we're entrusting ourselves to do what's right, I guess. You know.
Surprise.
So so anyway, I wanted to clarify that. And then to address Representative Edwards' comments, it is my understanding that the staff is there full time, and I also want you to know that the Historic Review Committee is a voluntary committee, and they had absolutely no idea that people were being charged to come before them. I mean, when we presented this, they were like all in shock that they were even, that we as a citizen in making this improvement had been charged to come before them to present our situation.
I don't have any problem with charging to staff hearings and approval meetings and any kind of paperwork. But for God's sakes, $435 just to paint your house the exact same color for the nice people that are going to come up here and testify against this bill. I would like to hear the justification of that kind of charge, especially from Portland. I don't live in Portland, but I'm up there and I want to hear it. I have a lot of constituents in the that do live in Portland.
Mr. Chair, you're going to find out that Portland does not do that.
Good. God bless them.
And they have a track that actually I think is very appealing, because they're there to help you, encourage you. Because what I see in America, which is very disturbing, if you go to Europe, you have 200-400 year old structures, and seems like we doze them. And I would like to see us preserve more of our heritage than we actually do. And I was very, very disheartened to find that in the city in Medford, we had two schools that were built around 1910 that were still structurally sound, but they didn't conform to what the superintendent thought was a good way to teach. So we ended up running a bulldozer through those two schools, and they were absolutely beautiful. They were just absolutely beautiful. And yet we continue here to doze our history instead of preserve it, and I would rather see us preserve it. But I'd like to see it do it in a manner that people that care about preservation of their homes and or their structures, that they should not be penalized for it, but they should be rewarded for it in some way.
And that makes scofflaws out of those that care about history. Okay, any further questions of these good people? I really appreciate you coming down and clarifying that. That's great. Okay, well, thank you. And now we're going to hear from some other nice people. I would like to call Tom Carter, David Barenberg, and Linda Ludwig, and hear your side of this story. I hope it's full of colorful testimony, like the good my friend from Medford. Cindy, would you like to come up, please, too? And Cindy Roberts.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Cindy Robert, proud to represent the city of Medford.
I did not sign up for a reason.
That's okay.
And but I find it necessary because you've asked these people to defend what my city has done, and I will tell you that I actually don't think it's defensible. So I think that there's an issue here, and the biggest issue is what are you getting for what you pay? In other cities, I know they do a lot. In the city of Portland, I had a friend who had a historic registry house, and they do a lot for you. What are you getting for what you pay? I just stepped out into the hall to call them and say, why 430? It's the minimum. It's the minimum. Unless you're just doing paint color, then the minimum is 200. I don't understand that. A minimum of 430. I said, what are you getting for that? And they said, we'll put you through to planning. And there was nobody there because they're out charging people. But here's my point. My point is that anything I can do to help the representative, and this is why I did not sign up to testify against the bill, anything I can do to help make the money follow the money, I'm happy to help try to do. And I will go back to the city of Medford, and I will try to get them to change this policy. I know the representative will work with me to try to get them to change the policy. And I know that you statutorily may want to make a change, but I just want you to understand that even the city said, okay, we need to better document that. We need to show what we're doing with that money and what the 430 minimum does.
I mean, you know, everybody in this business of government needs to do that, so it isn't unique under the city of Medford. And they're very well represented by you as well, in case they listen to your testimony. All right, who wants to go first? Linda, you want to go first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Linda Ludwig from League of Oregon Cities. You're getting passed out some written testimony, which really was just in response to the written bill and not hearing about the specific situation. And in reviewing the bill, it seemed clear to me that there was a specific situation. But let me give you a little bit of background noise. I'm sorry, my testimony says opposition to Bill 2745. It should read 2747. I just saw that in the back room. My head was reeling when I reviewed these bills because from our esteemed Representative Escobel. One, we had a fee bill allowing fees to be increased, and the other one, we had a fee bill asking that they be capped. And I was trying to come up with reasoning and justification for both of those instances, so excuse the typo there. The background noise, let me just give you a little bit of background here. Since 1983, cities and counties have been under the legislatively set standard that fees for processing permits, and for cities in the city portion of the statute, which is in ORS 227, it's for permits and land use reviews, it's no more than actual or average cost, and you've heard that. But I will say, because of the state's current economic environment, I'd like you to be sensitive to the fact that we're seeing a lot of planning departments laying off employees, both on the city and county level. And with many city planning departments, they're having to subsidize some of their planning activities from their general fund. And this, in some communities, is having some very direct outcomes of other types of services that the general fund provides. So that's a bit of background noise there. Having said that, in this very narrow type of application, which is narrower, I believe, in language of the bill, having said that, some cities do choose to defer fees. They do that in a variety of ways. Sometimes they defer them entirely. Sometimes they defer them to the time of permit. But I want to underscore these. These are cities that have the financial wherewithal right now, today, to be able to do that. Not all cities sit in that position to be able to maintain their planning staff and be able to defer fees. So that's kind of background noise. There's some additional information about our responsibilities for the state-mandated planning requirements and Goal 5 for historic resources. I say my comments absolutely respectfully, and I sympathize with Representative Esquivel's particular situation and the reason he brings this bill forward. The bill and the changes that you're looking at would affect approximately 45 cities with historic districts throughout the state. So I would ask that in consideration of this very specific issue, that we look at the outcomes if the committee does entertain legislation to those other 45 districts, which mirrors to a certain extent the good representative as well's comments about having a problem child and not wanting to affect necessarily other cities that have the ability to take different types of approaches. This is really, in some respects, a local issue that may need a local resolve, and we would be more than willing to work locally and see, in addition to any work the committee might want to do, if we can provide some solution for this issue.
Linda, before I go to David or Mr. Carter, I don't think any planning department should be being funded on the backs of historical sites. That's just wrong. That, you know, just because someone wants to maintain their historical property, that shouldn't require them to fund a planning department. That's why we have so much contention about fees and planning and development in this state. Now, you can use the same argument to say, well, we shouldn't have to build a school there because we don't, but that's a different subject, but, and you can reverse it. And people do all the time, although I don't think it matches perfectly. But certainly, in the narrowness of this issue, I certainly do not. If your planning department is being funded on the backs of someone with an historical property, you got some serious work to do at the local level, regardless of whether this bill passes or not. So those 45 districts that you just said are doing that, or may be doing that, they got some serious work to do. So I had to throw that out there. Unless I misunderstood
Mr.
I'd like you to respond, and then I'll go to Mr. Lipson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't disagree with you, and I wasn't trying to infer that 45 cities that have multiple, some of them historic districts, are doing that. Mr. Chair, I'm not even certain that we can say that definitively for the city of Medford. I wish their representatives were here today to give us that information.
Okay. And I'm sure we'll be hearing from them. Representative Kennemer?
Mr. Chair, I just, you know, your comment about historic districts not paying their fair share, I think you may find there are differences of opinion about that. And incidentally, as a former owner in one...
Representative, just to clarify, it was just the opposite. I did not suggest that historic districts weren't paying their fair share. I heard that the planning departments were using this money to pay for planning. It was the other way around. That's what I heard, and maybe I was wrong.
That's not true, but... I guess my point is, and having had a property in a historic district, and I would make a great effort to never do that again, I might add, because it's expensive and a hassle. But the other side of that is those historic districts do also add value to the properties. And you don't want a piece of junk, modern junk, put next to your historic home or your historic business, because it changes the appearance and changes the character of the neighborhood and the values of the property. So there is, you know, one of the standards that we try to apply is that there should be value for, there should be, you know, a benefit for your cost. And I think that's the theory here, and it should also be relevant to the cost, and I think in this case it was certainly out of proportion.
But I couldn't agree more, but that's not the issue before us. The value of historic districts is not what's at question here, or the expense to continue and maintain them. That's not the question. So, David, I'm going to you, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair Schaffler, and members of the committee. I'm David Barenberg, and I can claim thanks to Representative Esquivel. I'm from the helpful city of Portland, and with me today, Tom Carter, City of Portland Bureau of Development Services. And what I thought we would cover is just hear a little from the lobbyist and more from the actual practitioner who's working with folks on these specific issues to give you a picture of just what one city does in terms of its program on historic properties and be able to respond to some of the questions or issues you might have about how it works in the field. And, you know, just to emphasize
emphasize, you know, Portland clearly is just one of 45 cities with historic districts, and sometimes things are a little different in terms of Portland in size and scale. One thing just to clarify, on page 4 of the bill, there's in lines 3 to 4 just above, or lines 2 to 4 just above the the changes Representative Esquivel had in the original bill, was just the language that currently says the governing body shall establish fees charged for processing permits in an amount no more than the actual or average costs of providing services, which is what Portland does in terms of evaluating what it does and how it charges for them. It's consistent with what the statute, how the statute reads. We appreciate having met with Representative Esquivel and talked about our concerns, and appreciate the dialogue that we have had very much. With that, I'd like to pass the microphone on to Tom Carter.
Chair Schaffler and members of the committee, I'm Tom Carter. I live in Portland, and I work for the Bureau of Development Services in the City of Portland. I don't personally do historic reviews, but I have some knowledge about them. And we have 20 historic districts. There are 13 actual historic districts and 7 historic conservation districts in Portland. So it's a significant number of properties that are affected by our regulations. And I want to give you some background on how we administer those and some perspective on historic design review generally. Of course, the purpose of historic design review is to protect the value and the kind of the unique contribution to the character of the city that historic districts and conservation districts provide. And that said, I forgot my white hat, but maybe I won't have it for that long. We do exempt repair and maintenance of historic properties, and we from design review. And we also exempt if you don't need a building permit. And so that would be sheds. I should say if you want to add a garage or a parking pad, we do require a permit for that, even if it's small enough to otherwise be exempted from building permits. And so, you know, we're good guys for that. I should clarify, if you have a listed property and color of the house is part of the listing, you have to go through design review to paint your house. So there are, you know, you could still be caught in that. We don't just blanket accept everything. We do want to know what's going on in the historic districts.
Excuse me, if I may.
You may, if Mr. Carter doesn't mind you interrupting him.
Houses within a historic district, and then there are houses, many fewer, that we might have a specific historic listing. And so that's where a color would be included as part of this.
Historic landmark, yeah. Designated National Registry property, for example.
Okay. For the record, though, that's not, you are a National Registry.
Yes, we are.
National. Yes, and okay. So we would want to know, we would look, if Representative Esquivel were to come to us, we would look at the listing for his property to see if any of the things he's proposing to do, even if he didn't need a permit, were in the listing. If his house was a blue house, and it says, this blue house, it's a color picked by somebody or other, we would require him to have a review to verify and an inspection that he painted it blue. So there are levels of control, I want to make clear. And this is kind of building on the rest of the other testimony that, you know, different cities approach these problems differently. We're all faced with wanting to preserve this unique character, and we all take different approaches. So we don't want to know if you're just putting up a fence that we don't require a permit for. But we do want to know if you're making changes to a National Register property. So it's a nuanced situation. Now, if you do come in for a review, we charge the average cost. We've done studies on what it costs. And to kind of answer some questions that were already asked, those planners who do design reviews for us do all kinds of design reviews. But we're such a large jurisdiction, we have people who are devoted only to case review, and they also staff the Landmarks Commission. So that's part of the fee that you pay, is what's the fractional cost of having a Landmark Commission that will hear the appeals, and what's the fractional cost of having a certain number of cases that will be appealed. So we have plenty of statistics on this, so we're able to generate reasonable estimates of what the fees should be. Our sliding scale starts at amazingly, $405. I should say that an average hour of medium-level staff plan time, including overhead, is about $110 in the city of Portland. So support staff for providing notice and things like that is less, of course. We charge as much as $7,444 for historic design review for residential properties, depending on how big and complex and expensive the project is. And we based it on the value of the project, because that reflects, you know, how much work is being done, how much there is to look at. So all these cases that I'm talking about, it's very rare that nobody knew of a residential case that had started off with a hearing. So all these cases are decided administratively by a staff person. They only go to a hearing if there's an appeal at that point. So I wrote my testimony for the original proposal for the $100 cap, and you know, on average, we would have to shift $1,400 from the other services that our bureau provides, other reviews, other permit activities, other inspections, to subsidize those reviews. With these changes, of course, some of these concerns are addressed. But we do want to make sure that any outcome, you know, maintains our ability to provide these services fairly across the range of the range of people who approach us for permits and reviews, without unfairly favoring any group.
Okay, let's say I'll never own a blue house because my wife would never let me paint our house blue. if I own an eggshell white house and it's on the National Historical Register, and I come to you and I say, here's my paint color. It's exactly the same color I painted it 10 years ago. I'm going to paint it, and I'm in front of this administrative person. Are they mandated to charge me $405? Can they decrease it? Can they waive it? Underneath the is that under state statute? Is that a federal thing, a state, or is that a city ordinance, or all the above?
I'm Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, I can answer that. I work with people on the counter. I'm the person that you might talk to. I'm one of them. Mm-hmm. And I would say, I would look at the listing, and I'd look at what you're telling me, and I'd verify that the color's the same, or maybe it's not even required to be any particular color, and I would say, thanks for checking in with us. Goodbye.
No fee.
Go do it. No fee, no permit.
That's what
and
we need.
It is a city rule in this case. The city decided that they didn't need, the city of Portland, at any rate, looked at their situation, decided they didn't need to impose a review for this situation in those districts.
Okay.
But I would be looking at, you know, I would be looking at stuff in this case, and I think we've decided not to charge because you're spending, you know, 20 minutes of my time, 15 minutes
maybe
of my time.
Maybe not even that.
And I'm paid, that's kind of an overhead charge for us.
Now, I can understand, before I go to Representative Escobar, if they don't have the picture of their house, I mean, to be honest with you, I can give you a sample of what I painted my house 2 years ago. It's still in my garage. I still have the code number for that paint. Mm-hmm. And 10 years from now, I probably still will. And my so if they have a picture, they have a sample of the paint, they're going to color it, and I'm just there in front of your counter, literally, you look at it, it's not going to take you. I mean, you have to go check the listing, though, right? Forgive me, that does take some time. So then you would... in all likelihood, if I come to you, I didn't have a picture, I tell you, I promise you I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, then I can understand why you may, there's more research, more time, you may want to establish some kind of fee. I'm not saying people should get something for free, because I agree with Representative Kenner, does add value to your property. All right, Representative Esquivel, please.
A couple things. One is that you were talking about a $7,000 fee. Does that include going through the building department, getting the permit for the structural design? Is that what that is? Because I can't imagine why you'd need a $7,000 fee, because it's my understanding if you're on the National Register, you shouldn't be messing with the outside structure at all. It should remain intact. So please explain that one to me, if you would, please.
So, Chair Schaffler and Representative Escobar, this would be, I included in my research multi-dwelling residential, which is a commercial building permit. So it would have to be one of those. It would be hard to picture an extensive enough house to get to that point at the rate that we charge. But it is only the design review. And then once that's approved, you need to acquire a permit for the work separately, and it would have to match the outcome of the review. So it would be it would be very extensive renovation, but we wouldn't be looking at the structure. It would be the value of the work that's being done that is visible that would be looked at.
And go ahead, please.
And the other thing to address, preserving the value, which is like your CCNRs in your neighborhood, we have two different set of circumstances here. One is that you have a historic district. Two, you have a national registrar that does have a listing on what that's specifically for that house. But that does not pertain to the other houses that aren't on the registrar in the district. But what we're doing in our community, we're lumping them all together, which is not a good thing. The last thing is we paid for that value when we purchased the house. We paid extra to be in a historic district. We paid extra to have a 3,500 square foot house that's 2.5 stories with the Romeo windows and the 6-over-1s. So I understand that, and you want to preserve that because you don't want somebody next door putting T111 on their 1922 house. So I appreciate that, but that's value for value. I just don't comprehend the value that I received for what I paid.
Clearly, you have a good case. Now, in your defense, though, for the $7,000, when I was in Union, we remodeled. We totally pretty much tore down and rebuilt the old Howard House on Officers Row in Vancouver because it caught on fire. And there was extensive architectural design drafting went into that. And some historical inspector went, I'm sure they probably spent a lot more than $7,000 reviewing those plans, tremendously more. So I you can justify it depending on the size of the project and how much renovation is going on. And that's definitely not what I'm questioning. I don't believe that's what anybody appears questioning, including Representative Esquivel. I really like the way you do it there, and I think somehow if we can get that into statute, I would, because I do have sympathy to planning departments that are laying people off. I mean, have you been to Happy Valley lately? There's houses in the middle of construction that are literally rotting because it's stopped. So I sympathize with that. That being said, though, I do not think the historical funds should be funding our trying to maintain our planning department, and I don't think anyone disagrees with that. We beat this one to death, folks, but I do want to continue to pursue it, Representative, if you're going to have some changes or amendments, and I know you'll talk to these nice people. Unless you have anything else, I really appreciate you coming here. Yes, of course.
My good chair, I would very much like to wish happy birthday to our good representative.
Oh, good. Thank you very much. And Ms. Ludwig, make sure and go back to the League of Oregon Cities and tell your boss how nicely you were treated at this committee and how much we care about our local. Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the hearing of Hospital 2747. Anything for the good of the order? All right.